the fact that in my mind it is an area that we do by rote, sort of literally automatically, and we don't give much thought to it when we really ought to. It is an act of worship. It needs to be seen that way. And here in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, we see Paul involved in a what we would call a special offering. This was not the week-in, week-out offering that was collected in the local church. This was a special project that Paul had on his heart of these Gentile churches collecting a sum of money to send back to Jerusalem to supply the needs of the poor saints there. And so this was something very dear to him, something he had been working on a while, as we'll see here. So let us work. We went through 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and I pointed out several things that when it comes to how much we give, under the law, you didn't have any option whatsoever. You didn't have any leeway. It is specified what you are to give. In the new covenant, we just don't see that. We never see the tithe imposed as a legalistic thing that we must follow. I think it's a good guide, but do I have to, is there any amount? Some folks probably may not, because of their financial situation, to be able to give that much. Others may be able to give more. What we need to recognize under the new covenant, everything we have is to be seen as belonging to Christ. And therefore, we are to use our possessions as He would direct us in the support of the kingdom of Christ. And you say, well, just give me an amount. Give me a figure. Give me a percentage. Well, I can't do that. It varies too much depending on situations and circumstances. But certain things are true, and we'll see those today, certain principles that we are to keep in mind when it comes to giving. So let's read here in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. I just want to go through this chapter and share a few of these things with you. In verse 1, "For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write unto you, for I know the forwardness," or the fact that you were sitting on go of your mind, "for which I boast of you to them of Macedonia, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal hath provoked very many." Now, we think of Greece as one large country, not a large country, but one country, whereas in Paul's day, Greece, what we call Greece today, was broken up into several Roman provinces, one of which was Macedonia to the north. Remember, that is the area where Philip of Macedonia ruled, and his son Alexander the Great then conquered the known world and united Greece during that time. Till then, Greece was separate areas, separate city-states. They were not really connected as a coherent nation, partly because it's a very rugged place, and these cities were sort of separated from each other by mountain ranges. But it was in the days of Alexander the Great that the nation was brought together. But notice what Paul, when Rome conquered it, they broke it up into these regions or these provinces. Hello? Okay, anyway. One of those is Macedonia, and the other is down where Corinth is, further to the south, the Peloponnesian Peninsula, which they called Achaia. And then they had another province called Graecia. So these are different provinces in that part of the world we call Greece. So notice in verse 2, Paul says, "I boasted about your readiness to give to those who are up in Macedonia." In other words, I have already bragged on you to these churches that are in Macedonia. You say, well, what churches were up there? Well, Philippi, Thessalonica, those are the areas that were in Macedonia. Corinth is down in Achaia. And notice, I told them that a year ago, you were ready to jump in on this offering, and your willingness to give provoked them to give. In other words, giving, we see then, is somewhat infectious in that as we see others give of their substance, it helps provoke us to do the same. So, he says in verse 3, yet have I sent the brethren, these brothers, he says, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this behalf, that as I said, ye may be ready. In other words, I bragged about you, and now I'm sending these guys ahead of time to make sure that our boasting of you is not in vain, that we didn't brag on you when we shouldn't have. Verse 4, lest, haply, happenstance, if they of Macedonia come with me and find you unprepared, we, that we say not ye, should be ashamed in this same confident boasting. That is, I think it's one of my favorite expressions of Paul. In other words, we're probably going to be coming down to you, down to Corinth, from the north, and we're probably going to have some of the brethren from the churches in Macedonia accompany us. Now, I've bragged on you. I told them a year ago, you guys were ready to give. And should I show up, and these brothers from Macedonia have come with me, and they've already given, you see, by that time to this fund, and you're unprepared to give anything, we, not to mention you, would be ashamed, would be embarrassed. In other words, we've bragged on you, and we told them what you told us, you're ready to give. Now, do you preachers are sort of renowned for a number of things. One of the most prominent in modern times is fundraising, right? I have been in my younger days. Anybody ever hear of old Manly Beasley back in the old days? Manly was the best I ever saw at getting that 20 out of your billfold. Somehow, when I'd go to these conferences back there, this was in the early 70s, they always had Manly Beasley preach right before the offering. They knew what they was doing. He's the best I ever saw. He was one of these guys that could he could pull your heartstring. He could get that money out of your pocket. Preachers are sort of renowned for that. And Paul, as he doesn't want to seem like a fundraiser, you understand, but notice his tactic here. He's saying, you've made a commitment, and I don't want you to be embarrassed, not to mention me, but you be embarrassed that when we actually show up, you're not ready to give. You're not going to do anything. Yes, Dave. Yeah, we'll be humiliated. Yeah, I and you will be humiliated because we made this boast. We bragged about you to these churches. So I find that very interesting, the way that he approaches them, that they have made this commitment. It's like, the wedding yesterday has this fresh on my mind. The vows in the Old Testament work that way, that nobody forced you to make a vow. If you made a vow, you did it of your own free will. But once you uttered the words, if you said, I'm going to give God this or that parcel, the grain from this field or that cow over there, once you said it, you were locked in. You couldn't alter it. You couldn't change it. So they have already a year ago promised to give something to this offering. And so Paul is simply saying, I'm now coming to see that you follow through on what you once promised. So, verse 5, therefore, notice he's sort of covering his bases here. Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren, these brothers, that they would go up before unto you and make up beforehand your bounty, of which ye had noticed before, that the same might be ready as a matter of bounty and not as of covetousness. Let me try to translate that for you. What he's saying is, I'm sending these brothers ahead to go ahead and collect the money before I come. You remember Paul had said earlier in the previous chapter, he didn't want there to be any fundraising when he was there. So he's sending these brothers, whoever they are, the unnamed brothers, who are coming ahead to collect the money. So he says, before I get there, so that last phrase, that you might be ready as a mounter of bounty. Bounty is, Mutiny on the Bounty. What do we mean by bounty? This is that this offering will be a free will offering rather than a exaction. I think one of the versions uses, the ESV used that term. Dave, read what the ESV translates that last as, that you may be ready as a willing gift, rather than an exaction. What's the difference between those two things? One is you're doing it purely because you want to. The other is you're doing it, but you don't want to. You are having, it's like extracting teeth. This is like exacting. The tax man has come, has shown up. And so what Paul is trying to avoid is the impression that we're coming to exact this sum from you. When you made this commitment, we want this to be a ready expression of your heart. So he's taken great pains sending a sort of an advance envoy down there to collect these funds, so that that's not how it's going to appear when he shows up. He's going to let these guys do the dirty work. They're going to pass the plate. And speaking of passing, you probably are aware in some of the black churches the practice of passing the plate over and over again. You ever seen that done? They'll pass the plate, and the pastor looked at it and say, "This isn't enough," and they'll send it back around. Well, one of the most hilarious stories I believe I've ever heard, my pastor friend Holmes Moore up in St. Louis and his assistant pastor Tom Henry, one Sunday got invited to go speak at a black church in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, over in East St. Louis. So Holmes and Tom are going across the Mississippi over there, and they have this service. Well, the pastor gets up after the service and says, "We're going to take up a love offering for our white brothers here." And they pass the plate, and it comes back to the front, and the pastor looks at it and says, "This just isn't enough. You know, we got to do better than this." So they passed it again. I don't know how many times they passed the plate that day. But anyway, when Holmes and Tom are leaving, the black pastor comes over and hands Holmes an envelope with a love offering in it. So now they're in the car. They're headed back across the bridge over to St. Louis. And Holmes says, "Tom, open that envelope. Let's just see what's in there." And they opened it up, and there was $1.25. Well, Holmes gets to laughing and laughing. And Tom said, What's so funny?" And Holmes said, "I put the dollar in." And then Tom gets to laughing. He said, "What are you laughing?" He said, "I put the quarter in." Those folks decided those white brothers didn't need their money. But I told them later, I said, that's a perfect example of the more you give, the more you receive. You know. But anyway, Paul doesn't want the plate to be going around several times while he's there. He's sending these guys ahead. So here's the principles. We go through that. We sort of get the sense of the context here to get to these principles now that Paul throws out. In verse 6, I think this is out of Psalm 112, if I remember. He says, "But this I say," that's later on, "he who soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly. And he who soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully." Now you say, "Well, that sounds like health and wealth stuff." Well, in a way it is. That, yes, I want you healthy, wealthy, and happy. Just not necessarily here, not necessarily now. You understand that what's going on here is it is a principle of agriculture that if you sow one seed, how much of a harvest are you going to get? One stalk. That's the way it works. And so what Paul is pointing out is that the farmer who wants a big crop sows a lot of seed. Right? That's just the way it works. Now, keep in mind that we're not talking about, and we'll see as we work our way through this, that phrase it like this. Should we desire abounding fruitfulness? That's like asking a farmer if he wants a bumper crop. Of course, that's what he's doing. That's why he's sowing the seed in the first place, to get a big crop. So to say, well, do you want a big crop or a small crop? Asking a farmer that's what Paul is dealing here. Do you want abundant fruitfulness? If so, then you need to be sowing very liberally. Now, I want you to realize that sowing involves something. It means to take a commodity and cast it away in a situation where it's not going to advantage you for a long time. One of these days I'm going to find this photo or this painting again. of a farmer in the old days out in his field. He's got a bag of seed, and he's slinging it everywhere, sort of the old way you used to plant wheat and so forth. And his wife and his children are following behind him, crying. You see the expression in the painting. The wife is begging the husband to stop. And so here's the husband throwing the grain every which way. The wife and the children are weeping and crying behind him, and the wife pleading with him to stop. Because you realize that what's going on, this is their food. That sack of wheat is what they've got to survive on. And the husband is what? He's throwing it away. He's casting it out. And so you begin to put two and two together. What's going on in the painting? The wife and the children are begging him to stop. And yet the farmer realizes that the only way they're going to have enough to survive is if he casts their food supply away. He's got to put it in the ground. Underneath the painting was this verse, "They that sow in tears shall reap in joy." And the idea of sowing in tears takes on a whole new perspective, doesn't it? When you realize what's going on. And that's what Paul is alluding to here. To sow, this is not from your abundance, but from your supply. Sonny? Uh-huh. Yeah. He's risking it all. Yeah. He's betting the farm, as we say. Yeah. I think that's a good thing to say, that you begin to realize that in this case, this is not the excess that he's investing. This is his life. This is the farmer doing what he's got to do to make a living for his family, and that causes sacrifice if he's going to do it, if it's going to work. He can keep the whole sack of seed for the short term. Everything's going to be fine. But in the long term, it's going to be a disaster. Or he can think long term and sacrifice now that the harvest come later. And so there's that principle that's going on here in this verse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the crop fails. Yeah, certainly possible. Yeah. Well, and that's a question. We, from our perspective, from the human perspective, this is a risk. But is it from the divine perspective? Are we not given promises? And that's lying just ahead of us here, Sonny, that God is guaranteeing there will be a harvest. And so if with that perspective, it's not a risk. If we're looking at it through the eyes of faith, we're putting this in the hands of God, and he is guaranteeing you sow sparingly, you reap sparingly, you sow, what's the second half of this? You sow bountifully, you're going to reap bountifully. That's the promise. The problem is the promise, the fulfillment of that promise is a long way off. The farmer has to wait months for the return. And that's why the farmer is used often in the New Testament as an example of long-suffering and patience. James uses the same figure in the last chapter of James, that the farmer, the husbandman, he calls him, is an example of patience. The fact that you don't put the seed in the ground and get the fruit back tomorrow doesn't happen that way. It takes a long time before he gets it back. And so not only is he an example of throwing it away, as it were, wasting it for the present to gain it for the future, but it's also he's an example of patience and long-suffering, that he has to wait for the harvest. And in the same sense, our lives, we're basically sowing seed, and we're divulging ourselves of resources, and the immediate return may not be seen. In fact, in our lifetime, may not ever be seen. But it reaps eternal dividends, put it like that. So, look at verse 7 now. With this being the case, and we get back to this question, well, how much? And he says, well, every man, according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly nor of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. We have the idea, first of all, when it comes to how much as you purpose in your heart. And keep in mind, this is a special offering we're dealing with for the poor saints back in Judea. But notice that when it comes to how much, this is the only parameter. As much as you purpose in your heart. That's dangerous. You say, well, this can't possibly work. Our church won't function. We'll go broke. Well, maybe. But that's the risk we take. But that's the principle. In other words, the question is, will God's people respond? Do they have a heart to give? Paul assumes they do. It's pretty much been our experience here that God's people have a heart to give. You don't have to stand over them with a club and beat it out of them. And secondly, what Paul emphasizes next is not just what they give, but it's how they give. That it's very important that they give not grudgingly. Dave, again, the ESV, what word does it use there in verse 7 for grudgingly? Reluctantly or under compulsion. In other words, I just got to do this. I don't want to, but I've got to for whatever reason. Preacher standing there looking at me. I'm under this pressure. Others expected of me. But notice that the rule is what you can give cheerfully, because that's what God is looking at. He's looking for a cheerful heart, a heart that delights in giving. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but how many cheerful givers we got here? I just love to give. Well, there are some. There are people who love to give and happy to give. That's what we're to strive for. That's what God likes to see, that we just love to have the opportunity to provide, to give of our substance for the work of God. All right? Now, Sonny, we get back to your point a moment ago. Here in verse 8, Paul doesn't leave us there. He says, and God is able to make all grace abound toward you. Now, remember that sometimes the word grace is, we define it unmerited favor. In some places it is that. By grace are you saved through faith. Okay. That's clearly the unmerited favor of God. There are other places, this is one of them, where grace speaks of the thing that comes to us by grace. The substance. The grace, the gift of grace. Okay. And this is one of these places that this is what Paul is dealing with. In other words, God is able to make all grace abound toward you. The stuff of His grace, He is able to make that abound so that ye, always having all sufficiency in all good things, may abound to every good work. Now, this is the important principle here. You're saying, well, you're talking about health and wealth. But in a way, yes. In a way, what we're saying is that the more you give, this, what Paul is saying, is that God then is able to supply more grace, grace being what you give, back to you, but not that you can keep it, but that you can dispense it. In other words, it's like the pot that never runs out of oil, that you just keep pouring out of yourself, but as you're pouring it out, God is pouring more in. Yeah, Sonny? Yeah, yeah. Well, the difference, it's grace upon grace. There's the difference between quid pro quo, something for something, and grace for grace. Do you see what the difference is? Who was it? Somebody accused me of quid pro quo not too long ago. I said, I was trying to do something nice for them. They said, well, you're just, I'm saying, well, I got to pay you back. And they said, well, that's just quid pro quo. Well, it would be if the fact of what they had done for me wasn't grace in the first place. All I'm doing is recognizing the grace they have given to me by giving them grace. So it's not, in the legalistic sense, something for something, quid pro quo. It's grace for grace. And that's what Paul is dealing with here. The very fact that you had something to give in the first place is grace. And now you give it, God is supplying more of that grace. Grace in this case being the thing you give so that you can continue to abound in generosity and in liberality in your giving. That's exactly right. There's no contract. That's a good way of thinking about it. There is no thing that God says, if you will give me this much, then I will give you this much back. And the health and wealth gospel operates on that principle. Notice in this case, there is no guarantee. You're just trusting that God will do it. It's like the man who hires the workers at the beginning of the day. They've got a contract. Work for me all day long. At the end of the day, I'll give you a denarius. Okay? There's your quid pro quo. The others that he hires throughout the day, he just says, at the end of the day, I'll give you what you got, what's right. They have no contract. Well, what are they trusting? Not in the contract. They're just trusting in the goodness of the guy. And at the end of the day, he gives them a denarii just like he gave everybody else, which infuriates those who had the contract. But that's the whole principle here, is that the guy who's the farmer didn't have to pay them that. He just did it. He didn't owe it, didn't have a contract. So in this case, notice that God is supplying it back to us, but not to us as the bank, but to us as the conduit, as the pipeline. You see the difference? It's not coming back to us. Sometimes the economists today talk about the velocity of money. Have you heard that expression? In other words, it's different when you pay money and the economy money is being spent, but then it's just hoarded. Money doesn't move. What helps the economy go is the velocity of money. That here the employer pays the employee a salary who then turns around and goes out to the restaurant or goes down to the clothing store and spends that money. It's the velocity of money. It's the movement that helps the economy go. And so in this case, it's the same principle. God is not saying that if you'll, expend your resources and I'll give you a return so that you can hoard it. But what he's promising is I'll just keep putting it back in so that the pipeline never runs dry. There's always something more for you to give. And I have seen this principle many, many times in the ministry, that those people who are the best givers never run out of something to give. God just keeps putting more back in the pocket for them to give it again. It's an amazing thing to watch. Some of the people that come to my mind when I think of those who have the gift of giving, which is not one many folks spend a lot of time on their knees praying for. They want others to have that gift, not them, okay? But, if you want to seek the best gifts, then seek the gift of giving. Lord, make me a great giver. Those who seem to have that gift never seem to run dry of resources to expend. It's an amazing thing to watch. And that's then what the next couple of verses say. Verse 9, as it is written, he hath dispersed abroad. This is talking about God dispersing his good things abroad. He giveth to the poor. His righteousness remaineth forever. In other words, number one, this is what God does. God is a giver. He is a disperser to the poor. That ultimately we trace whatever we have back to God. It may have come through your employer. It may have come through a paycheck. But ultimately, its source was in God, him dispersing his good things. Then, verse 10, now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food and multiply your seed sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower. In other words, we're back to the agricultural picture. Imagine the farmer with a sack of seed. He's going out to sow wheat in his field. Who ministered, supplied the sack of seed in the first place? Well, it's God. And this is our old friend Epikourageo here in Greek. You remember when we were talking about the Christian life over in 1 Peter chapter 1, this word to minister. Korageo is that old Greek word that originally started out but with the Greek plays in Athens. You had someone who was a lover of the arts who then had deep pockets, who supplied, he hired the actors, he rented the performance place. In other words, you've got what we would call today in modern parlance a producer. The producer is the guy who's bankrolling the thing. And this chorageo, the chorus, by the way, we think of a chorus today as the singers, but originally the chorus was the dancers. In fact, it's where we get our word choreography from this same root. So you have these actors that come on the stage singing and dancing. You remember the prodigal son when he returned? No, I'm sorry. It was the older brother who came back and he heard the sound of music, symphonia in Greek. We get a word symphony from that. And dancing, chorus. That's that word chorus. So we think of chorus as singing. You're in the chorus. You sing. No, chorus originally was the dancers. And so the chorageo is the guy who hires them, who pays them. He's the guy who has the deep pockets, who's going to put on this production and bankroll it. And that word, over time, took on the meaning of ministering. Ministering in a physical capacity then. In other words, you're the one, if you're the minister, you're the one who's reaching into your deep pockets and pulling out the resources to supply what is needed. And that's exactly how Paul is using it here in verse 10. Now he who ministers seed to the sower, it's epichorageo, fully supplying what was needed to the sower. Well, he's talking about God. He's the one who has fully supplied whatever we've needed for the harvest. He's the one with the deep pockets. Let's put it that way. He's got all the riches that he will then minister bread for your food. How's he going to do it? Through the harvest. And he will multiply your seed sown. The point is, you don't put one seed in the ground hoping to get one seed back. Be a little self-defeating if that were the case. You want to get a whole bunch of seed back. And I think I told you one time about how many, you put one kernel of corn in the ground, how many kernels you get back from one stalk, from that one corn. It's a whole bunch. I can't remember what it was. It's a whole bunch. I think I figured up at one time it's possible, because most corn stalks have two ears. Some in special cases may have three. And when you look at the number of kernels, it could be as many as 500 or 600 kernels of corn you got from one kernel of corn. I mean, that's incredible. And that's what Paul is alluding to here. That God is able, first of all, to minister epichorageo, what you need as when it comes to sowing. He's able to supply you with what you're going to put in the ground. Then he's also the one who will multiply your seed sown so that you get a whole big fruitfulness from a little bit of what you put in the ground. And he will increase the fruits of your righteousness. And this ought to be a lesson to us. He's not talking about increasing your bank account. He's talking about increasing the fruits of your righteousness. The thing that this is devoted to produces in the long run. The righteousness that God would love to see. So, let me see where we are here. We got to quit. Let's finish up. Being enriched, in verse 11, in everything to all bountifulness, which causes through us thanksgiving to God. This is the last subject, these last five verses, is that the ultimate end, the end game of all of this, is that glory and thanksgiving be reflected back to God. The one who started the ball rolling in the first place, the one who supplied the seed sown, the one who multiplies the seed and enables the harvest, that all of this ultimately redounds to his praise. It's sort of like at the Academy Awards, the producer being honored for the best picture of the year. You say, well, why would you honor him? Why not honor the writers or the screenplay or the actors or actresses? Well, because this is the guy who bankrolled the whole production. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for him. He's the one that started. You think those guys are working for free? He's the one who's got to put his money up. And so he's the one, when they announce best picture, guess who goes up there and gets the award? It's the producer. Not the actor, not the writer, not the musicians, the guy who bankrolled it. In other words, the glory returns to the one who started the whole process in the first place, which is just right. And so these last verses are going to emphasize that. For look at verse 12. Here's the explanation. For the administration of this service not only supplies the want of the saints. Oh, yes, it does that. When you give food to somebody, you're meeting a need. When you build a house for somebody who's homeless, you're meeting a need. So it is meeting the wants, the needs of God's people. But it's not only that. Well, what else is it doing? He says, but is abundant also by many thanksgivings unto God. This same gift that met the need of the saints also produces great thanksgiving to God. Obviously from the one who received it. It's sort of like the old story about the woman, you know, in the old days when you always had your windows open in your house, she's praying at her kitchen window, praying she didn't have anything to eat. And these little boys were hiding just outside listening to her pray, and she's praying that God might supply her some food. And so they run off, and they go to their homes, and they bring back some food their mothers have fixed. And when she's not looking, they put it up on the windowsill. And so she comes back, and she sees the food sitting there on the windowsill. She just got through asking God to supply her some food. And she comes back to the windowsill, and there it sits, and she's thanking God for being so good and for giving her these gifts. And finally, the little boys go to laughing, and they start mocking her. They said, well, God didn't send you that. We did. We brought it. And she said, well, you might have been the bringer, but God was the sender. You see, that's the point. God may use a lot of different avenues to send it, to be the bringer, to be the conduit to get it there. But ultimately, the saint recognizes, what's the doxology say? Praise God, from whom all blessings flow. Ultimately, the praise redounds to God. Even that old honorary boss you got, who gives you your paycheck, you get it, and who do you thank? Thank God, supplied this need. And so, he will finish by saying in verse 13, while by the proving, the demonstration, the manifestation of this ministration, they glorify God for your professed subjection unto the gospel of Christ and for your liberal distribution unto them and to all men. Again, to try to put that in modern lingo, they're watching your action, which to them is the proof of your subjection to the gospel, this gospel of Christ. Now, he's talking about the Jewish saints back there in Jerusalem. They're going to get this offering of all places from Gentiles that the Jews typically look down their noses at. You know, not on the same level as us. And here they are seeing Gentile saints willingly using their resources to meet needs back in Judea. Do you see the impression that this would have on them? In other words, what would have caused such a thing to have happened? That these people that we tend to look down our noses at have turned around and blessed us. Let's use in like migrant workers that have come across the border to work out in the fields have so very little, whom we tend to look down our noses at least economically, and they have pooled their money to give us a gift. Do you understand the impression that would have on you? What in the world would motivate them to do it? And Paul is saying that's what subjection to the gospel of Christ does. That's what being gospel-oriented does. It produces a heart wanting to give. And so he goes on to say, verse 14, and by their prayer for you who long after you for the exceeding grace of God in you. They love you. They care for you. And here's the expression of their love and care. And then he ends, as Paul ultimately does, he's going to point you back to Christ. He says, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift. Unspeakable here doesn't mean we're not supposed to speak of it. but just means that we cannot possibly speak of it in a way that corresponds to the immensity of it. Words will fail us to speak of the immensity of what God has done for us through His Son, Jesus Christ. And so if we asked ourselves, what is the great motivation for giving in the mind of Paul and in the New Testament? It is the fact that we have been the recipients of such a great gift from God, His Son, Jesus Christ. All that He's done for us at the cross. And that is the motivation. And that's what He ends with these Gentiles now. Their subjection to the gospel is what is moving them to dig deep in their pockets and take up this offering, this collection, for you folks back in Judea. Okay. No, go ahead. Never too late. Well, it's, Sonny, a good explanation would be it's like you being joyful sending a check to the IRS. I don't know too many folks that just jump up and down on April 15th saying, whoopee, I get to give money to the government. Because it's an exaction. Yeah, well, that could be. It's what they're going through at the moment. Things like that. Yeah, right. Well, it points out that there's always a reason, no matter what we're going through, to be happy about giving. There's always a reason. There's always something that we can fixate our thinking on that says, for this reason here, I ought to be grateful. The very fact that I have it. All right, let's pray. We'll conclude. Father, we give You thanks and help us to be cheerful givers. May we rejoice in the fact that You have blessed us so in the first place. And may we be willing to part with what we have, put it in the ground, to await a greater harvest ahead. May it be our desire to see the kingdom of Christ advanced in a mighty way. And may we do that through it be done through our being willing to sacrifice. And Father, may our willing to sacrifice come from the great example of our Savior and Lord who sacrificed Him for our sake. May that always be the touchstone. And may it be our desire that, Lord, that the giving, whatever we do to advance the kingdom, the praise and glory won't come back to us, but will go to heaven itself, to Your throne. May we be praising Thee, for You're the one who started the ball rolling. It wouldn't have happened without. And so may indeed all our thanks be in Your direction. Thank You for blessing us today. Help us as we worship You today. May it indeed be the free and joyful expression of our heart.